This is Dylan FM, a Freak Music Club podcast. I'm Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place. This season, we're going deep on Time Out of Mind to celebrate its 25th anniversary. Here's your host, Craig Danieloff.
We spoke to Mark Howard, the engineer on Time Out of Mind, a few episodes back when he told us about recording the album in Oxnard, California and Miami, Florida, and about the techniques he used to get the album's famous sound and much more. Mark has just released his second book, a collection of photography taken in the studio with Dylan as well as with dozens of other artists that he's worked with over the years. It's called Recording Icons / Creative Spaces. The creative world of Mark Howard. Mark rarely works in actual recording studios like the Criteria Studios in Miami, where they made Time Out of Mind. More typical for him is what happened when he and Daniel Lenoir did Oh Mercy. They rented a house for a few months and turned it into a recording studio. Mark has worked all over the world that way, in all kinds of cool places and with an amazing roster of recording artists. And he brings a camera and takes pictures while he works. He's done so for over 30 years, and almost none of these shots of the most famous people in the world making some of our favorite albums have ever been seen. But now they're in his new book. Fiona Apple, Iggy Pop, Neil Young, Dave Grohl, Emmylou Harris, Sheryl Crow, the Neville Brothers, Willie Nelson, Joni Mitchell, and Bob Dylan are just some of the artists he's worked with and photographed. I talked to Mark about his book, his unique photographic process, and some of the great people he's worked with. In a moment, you'll hear that interview. The book itself is now available on Amazon, and you can find a link in the show notes. We have a copy to give away, and we'll be doing a drawing to choose the winner on Friday, November 18th. There's a link to enter to win that book in the show notes. But for now, here's our second talk with Mark Howard. Mark, hello, welcome. Great to talk to you again.
Yep, nice to talk to you too again. That's great.
Yeah, I'm excited that the book we talked about months ago is finally, I think it's out in about 2 weeks from the day we're talking, probably very close to when this airs. A book you've had in the works. What's the oldest photo in the book? This book, you've been taking these photos for a long, long time.
Yeah, I guess the oldest one would be probably the Neville Brothers' Yellow Moon record. That's kind of like where it all started. And so the books got some really great shots from those sessions in New Orleans. And so I would say that was the beginning of my kind of voyage, really. And then just after that, it was like we moved into Bob Dylan's Oh Mercy record. And then after that was Daniel Lanois' solo record. And then it just kept going, and for 30 years it didn't stop. So, and I was hired by Daniel Lanois to just do a 6 month period recording with helping him record the Neville Brothers, and so it just never stopped, and I never went back to Canada, and I ended up living in America for 30 years.
And tell me a little bit about how you shot it. Looks like in the book, some are sort of regular photos. There's a mix of styles in there. The thing I liked the best was these kind of fly on the wall photos where you're really getting a sense of what it's like there, not something staged or all publicity oriented. You just people hanging out, working, concentrating on what they're doing, but natural.
Exactly. So I kind of developed this technique with my Nikon camera. And I would do time-lapse photography. So I would just put my camera on top of a speaker or on top of the console, and it would capture a picture every 30 seconds. And so I would have like the whole day kind of like mapped out. And I started doing it because of I was documenting kind of like when you go back and you think, what guitar was that I used on that song? And what microphones were we using? So it was kind of a more of a technical journalism in the beginning. And then it kind of like, I thought, wow, these photos look really cool. And so I started kind of, gathering them up. And then I started to take shots of the locations and like, you know, the whole house and around it and the environment around it. And so when I was in Hawaii, I would be taking pictures of all different kinds of places around it. And then, so it gives you a vibe of where the location was. Yeah. So it kind of started that way as a documenting of gear type of thing. And then, you know, people were getting captured in these photos and, you know, doing their guitar overdubs or singing. And, you know, like Aaron Neville sitting there on the chair, you know, singing right into a Beyer 88 was that he did all his vocals in. So, yeah. So months down the line, you want to fix something and you can't remember what exact guitar was that. Cause you go through many different guitars and you go through different mics. So, yeah, so it was more documenting that, and then it turned into kind of me really getting into it and documenting the environment and, and then concentrating on the artist. And so I got great shots of just me and Robert Plant, just, you know, him working on his songs and me kind of getting ready to record them and stuff like that. So, so they became... kind of like capturing people in their natural habitat, you know. It's like National Geographic catching animals in their, you know, the wilderness. So yeah, so but you know, when you hold a camera up to somebody's face and you take a photo, they change their facial expression changes or they shy of whatever. Bob Dylan said no photos in the studio. He said that's you're stopping time. I don't want that, and so. I've snuck some Polaroids out, the documenting Polaroids that just happened to have some photos of him working on his lyrics and stuff like that. So it's pretty cool.
Given that you have these, you know, inside the action photos now in the age of box sets and reissues, has anyone come to you? Have they been used anywhere else before your book? Because it seems like there's so many famous albums you have shots of the formation of. I would think the box set people would be all over you to use these pictures somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, there was this Dylan thing that you were working on. There was a bunch of photos that came from the, I didn't take those shots, but they were documented by Bob Lanois in the studio of Dylan when we were in Miami. And so those ones kind of resurfaced at this exhibit, right? The Dylan one in, where was it?
Oh, the in Tulsa, yeah.
In Tulsa, yeah. So they surfaced there. But nobody else has kind of contacted me about, you know, I've kind of like secretly been holding a lot of these things. And so I've used them in my own book, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Let me ask you about your role a little bit, the engineering role. At these recording sessions, you know, it's not something a lot of people know a lot about. So you tend to be there with, and you've been a producer and engineer and a musician. So you've been in all the roles in this, but yeah. In most of these where you were, I think primarily you've been the engineer, how many other folks are besides the band, the artists tend to be involved or in the studio? Is it sort of you and the producer and the band, or is there more people involved?
I've always kind of like worked kind of by myself in the fashion that I don't have assistants or anything like that. But I've always been given creative freedom to how I want to record these sessions and what equipment I want to use and stuff like that. So I've never been ever told like I want you to do this or that. I've always had like a creative freedom of doing how I do it. And, you know, and a lot of that is accidental a lot of times, you know, by, you know, you get drum sounds, but then suddenly you find out that the vocal mic has a better drum sound than all these microphones all put together. And so you end up just using the leakage out of a vocal mic that's just sitting in a corner of the side of the room or something like that. So a lot of accidents happen like that in discovery. Because usually an engineer is told what to do by a producer. I want you to use this microphone on here, and I want you to do that there. And you're more directed, and you're more of it's a laborer or kind of
just kind a of technician, thing. Yeah.
technician. You're just a technician, and that's all you're asked to do. Where me, it's more musical, and it's more, you know, my opinion is always heard. You know, it's like me and Bob Dylan would be sitting at the console, and we'd do three takes, and he'd ask me first. He goes, "What take do you think it is?" And I'd say, "I think it's take two. It feels best." And he goes, "Wow, how did you know that?" And like I said, it just feels best for me. And so it wasn't the producer that he was asking. It was like, right, you know, me who he trusted in my opinion. So that's the way it's always worked for me. And that's kind of like how I got into, you know, producing records and people, you know, it's a lot to do with trust mostly. And once you have the trust of the artist, then you have the freedom to kind of do anything you want in a way of, you know, techniques and stuff like that.
And the one great thing about the book is it shows off all these locations, and I don't know if they're exotic, but they're kind of unusual, at least for recording, in these beautiful houses and in many different places. I know that was, you know, from, I read your book as well, which we'll put the link in the notes for people to go find your book called Listen Up, but that you identified these houses or these locations to go record, and you set it up and have people come in. And then I think in the Old Mercy story, you went down and you went and bought guitars, even procuring instruments for the band members. It's kind of, it's surprising to me as someone not involved that, you know, that's, you know, that they wouldn't want to bring their own, or they'd be open to, "Hey, I've got this drum set, or I got these set of guitars," right, or.
Yeah. Well, I wore many hats in the early days, and it's not like I would find the locations to make these records. And then I would find the instruments that we're looking for to make these records. And I was like, I would handle all the bills and everything. It was like only a one-man kind of crew. So I was able to kind of like, you know, because I had hands in every pocket, I kind of controlled the whole, how it all kind of came together. And it got, you know, crazier and crazier as time went on, because, you know, we were me and Daniel Lamois were moving around, and we moved to Mexico for a while, and I had to kind of figure out how to get all the gear into Mexico and all that stuff. And so I became an importer, exporter, and hiring trucks and bringing them down, all the gear, and then getting it out of there before our 6 months were up. And, you know, so it became a lot more than just an engineer. I was kind of like, you know, doing many different jobs at the time. And we ended up, after the Bob Dylan record in New Orleans, we ended up, Daniel ended up purchasing this place called Kingsway. Well, we named it Kingsway. He did. But we stayed there for maybe 5 years, and then we carried on the voyage, and that's when we went to Mexico, and then ended up at the Teatro Cinema in Oxnard, California, which was like a 1940s Mexican porno cinema that I converted into a studio. And so I would go into these locations and convert them to kind of like a workable playground. So the Teatro, everything was there was pianos and organs. And so wherever you would walk in the room, it was kind of like you sit down, play the piano, and I could just record you right away. There was no setup. And so that was great for Bob Dylan. He had an idea. He'd go to the piano, play it over there, and then he'd go play on the organ. And so he would, it's a kind of musical playground that I kind of created for the Teatro. And so I always kind of have that when the band or the artist walks in the room, I want to be able to record right away. And don't want them to like wait around, you know, for setups and stuff like that. And because I kind of started in a live world, I'm very fast at getting setups done. And so I treat every session like they're walking on stage, and bang, you know, they're playing and I'm recording it. And so a lot of those recordings, first take, second take, they don't even know they're recording. And those are the ones that usually are the best. So, you know, because suddenly when the record light goes on, a lot of people get nervous, and, you know, it's like you don't get those great performances that, so there's a lot of trickery going on sometimes.
Yeah, and a lot of those locations are homes. You know, there's mansions, there's these Malibu houses in your photo. There's some things down in Mexico. In terms of sound, I guess, you know, someone would think that, you know, a sound studio that's engineered and optimized and is made for recording sound would be an easier place to record. What is the impact of those unique environments on the results that you get? Or on the techniques you have to use to get those results, I guess.
Yeah, well, a lot of those locations, the sound of those locations are the sounds of those records, you know, because like if you work in a normal controlled environment, like in a normal recording studio and the guy's in a glass booth, you're only limited to those type of sounds where, you know, if you're in a house and it's got an interesting bathroom or there's a great kitchen, you can, you know, put drums anywhere and have them, you know, exciting sounding in a tiled room, but you don't get that in a studio. The studios have been kind of all deadened and, you know, just for, you know, so that they can control it. And so my guerrilla approach to recording makes it a little bit more interesting. And like I said, you know, found sounds that happen and, happen in those type of environments, you know? So I think by moving around and you're never in the same environment, you're going to be creating new sounds that you haven't created before. So, and, you know, like, oh, we're limited. We don't have any percussion instruments. So I'll find a box and put rocks in it. And then and that becomes like the sound of that one song's shaker or whatever. And same with guitars, you know, to play a guitar in a nice big open room with high ceilings. With just one mic on it, you capture the air around the guitar, and that, where if you're in a normal studio, it's very dead and you got to use many microphones to capture a vibe of a room and stuff like that. So, yeah. So, being able to be in new environments is very creative, and, it makes for a more interesting record. And I think that's a cooler way to make records than just kind of standard kind of doing the thing every time. You put your drums in the same spot in the studio, but this way you kind of got new ways to record everything. It's pretty good.
And how do the musicians react to that? Meaning, does it impact their expectation of the sound? I know in your book you talk, for example, about getting some guitar sound that Neil Young, you know, really, really loved. Is that the equipment you're using? Is that these unique locations?
It's got a lot, you know, to do with the location. We were recording in this house in Silver Lake in Los Angeles, and I had my gear set up in the hall of this kind of house that had like a huge spiral staircase that went up, and because of that, I had some subwoofers, and so I was treating Neil's guitar with the sub box that I had, where I was putting low frequencies in his guitar. So every time he hit that low note, it was like it would just shake the house, and just like his could feel his pant legs move. And so he never had that feeling before, because, you know, maybe live you would get a feel of it, but when you're standing in front of it, he was just excited about the sound, and it made him play a certain way because he was reacting off the sound he was listening to. And so I don't usually use headphones in the studio. I just use all the playback or the speakers. I kind of design the speaker system wherever I am. If I'm in a small room, I usually won't use a sub, but if I'm in a big room, I'll kind of have some big 18-inch subs, and it just sound pressure makes you play differently than you would in a room with headphones on with your amp in another room. So you're working off of the sound pressure. And I did a bunch of overdubs with Edge from U2 at the Teatro, and I had a PA in there, and so I pumped the track through this PA, and so it was like live, and had his guitar really loud, and so he just kind of was like, you know, in heaven, just being able to play that way. You know, it's a luxury to have that available to the artist. You know,
so the Teatro we talked about last time was where you started with Dylan, where he started coming down for the House of Blues mix and then spend time. You have that one picture in the book of the teatro with there's a guitar on every seat in the, you know, in the, what was that one? Did you set that up for the photo or is that just how someone stored their guitars for a while?
Yeah. So that was, I took out all the middle seats of the theater and I built a deck. So it was like a big, huge kind of like stage right in the middle of the theater. And I left all those theater chairs at the back of the theater. And so we ended up, they were guitar stands. So it was like we'd have the whole collection of guitars all ready to go. And you just walk over and pick, you know, oh, I want to, you know, 57 gold top Les Paul, or I want a butterscotch, you know, Telly, or, you know, it's like we had the best instruments all available for whoever walked in the door. So it was, so it was kind of like the collection was on, always out, and you could just always pick up whatever you wanted. So it worked out as really cool guitar stands.
Yeah. I'll mention some of the other photos. You have Neville Brothers photo. It looks like it's in a car or something where the group is four or five guys in the back seat.
That's right. Yeah. I didn't take that shot. That was shot by Christine Alicino from San Francisco. And she just down and she got the guys all in a car and took that picture. And she took some of those other ones in the studio too that were kind of more posed looking. There's a little bit of mixture of photos in my book that Danny Clinch has got a couple of shots in there and a couple of other contributing photographers that let me use their photos. Karen Kuhn was the photographer that did the beautiful shots of Kingsway, the New Orleans studio that was kind of more Bordeaux kind of pictures. They're like timeless, you know, black and white.
Yeah, there's some beautiful Joni Mitchell photos in there. Some of these, maybe.
So that was hurts. Camera on top of the speaker. And so there's a whole, maybe 30 of them of her just smoking cigarettes. And I had Brian Blade in there playing drums on some tracks of hers. And so, yeah, so it's there's a couple of cool ones that I picked out of all of those. And there's one that's kind of a ghosty shot where two pictures were taken and then one overlapped. So her head is, she's smoking a cigarette, but then she's also smoking a cigarette over here. So it's this kind of ghosty head on her. It's pretty, pretty cool. So, yeah. So, you wouldn't get that normally if you were just being a photographer, you know, it's like time-lapse photos are that way where you capture it and you move because the lens stays open for a certain amount of time because it was dark. And so those kind of, was long exposures, and so when you move, you get like that trail. So I love that kind of stuff. So it happens accidentally, but you get great shots that would never normally be like that. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. So Ricky Lee Jones, another set of great pictures in the book. Anything you remember about that recording or taking those photos?
Yeah, they were also my camera just sitting there on the table and she was playing her guitar. And then I'm not sure. I think there's another one with her and a drummer just listening and they're just kind of sitting on the couch listening. And so that was here in New Orleans where that was done at Esplanade Studios. And so in a big church. And so she had fired her producer and called me and I flew in from LA and finished the record for her.
So you must have a lot of outtakes from the, if this thing was auto shooting every, at intervals.
Hundreds. So yeah. And it's, sometimes it's hard to pick because you have so many great ones, but you know, you gotta pick, you know, at least for the book, it was kind of difficult sometimes, you know, cause I wanted certain things that meant certain things to me, but you know, the book publisher said, you know, we can't have 500 photos in here. We gotta trim it. And so, they had a lot of input on it too. So
yeah, there's, it looks like a very young Fiona Apple.
Yeah, it was at the Paramore. I had found this house. It was like a 1920s movie star estate owned by Antonio Marino, who was the first Latin lover of silent films. He was like before Rudolph Valentino, And he was like a star of this huge silent film called The Sheik. And so that's kind of like how all those movies started. So he married a Daisy Canfield, who was like the oil tycoons of Los Angeles. And her father built this huge 22-room mansion on the top of Silver Lake, up right up Mitchell Trina Street. And so they died mysteriously, drove off of Mulholland and died, and ended up the house got donated to these nuns, and these nuns ran a school for wayward women. And so there was a lot of like young girls in there. And Tom Petty has claimed that he would go there and climb over the fence to smoke cigarettes with some of the girls there. So there's all kinds of mysterious stuff. But yeah, so that was one of the great locations that I was in for about 5 years.
So you got pictures of Willie and Emmylou both separately and together. But
yes.
Did Emmylou work on Willie's album, or how come they happened to be there together?
Emmylou was invited to come in and sing on a couple of tracks of Willie's. Willie was only meant to do like three or four songs, and we ended up doing 21 songs in 2 days. And when Willie would play a song, and I go, "Willie, that's a great song. Did you just write that?" He goes, "Oh no, I wrote that in the 40s. I'm like, "How can you remember a song from the 40s? And so anyway, we worked the song up, and then once we got it recorded, I would play it back, and I would put a mix down just as a reference. And then so at the end of the night, I put it all on a CD, and we go listen on Willie's bus. And that ended up being the record. I never put the tape up ever again, and I never mixed it. It was just my playback mixes that's Willie, the Teatro record sound. So we just kind of nailed it right on the spot. And so Emmy was invited to sing, and it's a unique kind of singing that if you notice on that record where she kind of ghosts him as he sings it. She's like, they're not singing together. She's kind of slightly delayed from it, and it made for a really cool effect, and it's beautiful. And so I think that that's how Emmy got involved, definitely. And we made the record, and then Daniel Lanois was talking to Wim Wenders, and he goes, "Oh, always wanted to make a film with Willie." And so he came back in and we re-recorded the whole Teatro record for this film that Wim Wenders shot. And so
we
invited a bunch of people up from LA, and Woody Harrelson was there, and I was about to start a record with Marianne Faithfull. So she was there. And so he made this beautiful little film that it came out only on video. And I don't think it was ever released on DVD or anything like that, but it was a shame. But it's kind of a masterpiece in a way. So there's two versions of Teatro. So if you see the film, it's not the same.
Oh, as
the
well,
so
I have to look for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your Dylan photos, those ones are mostly at Teatro. You got a few of them seems to be outside. There's one of him in a big leather chair where he's kind of looking off to the side. It's atmospheric.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a mixture between Criteria and the Teatro. I kind of mixed them up. So I think that the Miami shots were done from Bob Lanois, who came in to film the making of the record and kind of thing. And it was funny because Bob came in and he had went and bought like $1,000 worth of candles, and he set it all up and in the studio and had the lights off. And then Bob walks in and in the back door, and it's dark and it's all these candles. He goes, "What the hell's going on? Is there a seance in here?" He goes, "Get rid of these candles and turn the lights on." So it was kind of a funny thing. So a lot of those shots from Miami were prints that were taken from video from the session. So right. So they've got a lot of grain in it. And then same thing with the shots from the Teatro. They're done on an Nikon. And so because it's so dark, you know, the grain on those, like the front cover is kind of smeary looking. There's other shots. But if you look at that front cover, you'll notice by Bob's head, right behind him. That's me at the console. There's like the outline of my body right there. And so there's a bunch more shots that are clear, but they picked that as the cover. So it was.
But that shot. That shot I've heard is credited to Lanois. Was that your camera, or who shot that shot originally?
Lanois had taken some photos from those sessions, and then there was just camera laying around the studio that some other photos were taken from. So yeah, it was a mixture of different cameras.
Let me, while we're talking about Dylan and some things that people have asked me since our last conversation, I wanted to get a little more information from you about. You talked about this going back and forth with Bob at the end of Time Out of Mind, and he had a cassette that he really loved the sound on and wanted you to sort of match. And at one point you kind of talked about taking that cassette and using it in the process. Can you kind of clarify what that was the master from something that was a cassette, or you're trying to match the sound he heard and liked on the cassette?
Yeah. So like the cassette that I gave him of all the mixes, like Bob had came back to the Teatro and we went through all the songs, and I mixed some, and some I couldn't better the mixes of, like Lovesick, and that was just from playback in Miami. And so what it was is I was making him these really hot cassettes on a Maxell XL2S, and that was the tape of the time. That was like the best sounding cassette. And so I had these Tascam cassette decks. And so I would print with the needles just buried to make them really loud and exciting. And so when we went to master the record, we mastered it, and I brought him a CD, and he would put the CD in and then listen to the CD, but then he would listen to the cassette, and the cassettes just sounded more exciting and like more alive. And so I was going back and forth between the mastering, and so finally, we ran it through a lathe, for vinyl, and tried to capture tube sound, and we couldn't get anything close to this cassette. And so I just, at the end, I just threw up my arms and I brought the cassette deck in, and we mastered through that cassette deck. And that's the sound of Time Out of Mind's mastering. So
explain that to me. When you say mastered to the cassette, you're saying the copy you burned to the cassette got then re-recorded?
No. I made a sequence on a cassette for Bob to listen to of all the songs. So he had the full record on a cassette. And so to get that cassette sound on the CD, I had to run all the mixes through that cassette deck and then print it onto a CD. And so
you're saying the sound signal path went through the cassette and back out.
That's correct. And so it was in record, but it was the only way I could get that sound. And so
that's amazing. So something in the electronics in that cassette was giving it a feel.
In the cassette player.
Player, I get it. Yeah, that's what I misunderstood. I thought you went to tape and then came off. You just went through those electronics.
Yeah, I went through the electronics of the Tascam cassette deck with a cassette in there recording, and then just taking the output of that and printing that. And so
that is wild.
I never told him that. I just did that and then went to his house, dropped off the CD with that new sound, and I get a call from him. Hey, Mark. That CD sounds great. And so I never told him any of the techniques that what happened, but he ended up liking it. And so that's the sound of that record.
That's wild. So you have all this expensive, Neve control panels and all this stuff, and you go through a $200 cassette deck.
Yeah. A lot of that was originally used, Joe Gass was the mastering engineer, and all of his work that he did on the tracks was used, but we just, the end result of that mastering went through the cassette deck to print onto the master, this glass CD master for making CDs and stuff. So yeah.
Right. Wow. Yep. So since we've talked, I've talked to, maybe 20 different people, musicians, authors, all kinds of folks about Time Out of Mind and the sound of that record. What can you say about kind of the role, like what's interesting to me is there's what Bob did, there's what you did, and then Lenoir's role. When you hear that album, how do you break down who contributed? I'm not trying to, you know, I don't know. I'm just wondering what drove that sound in terms of the different people's role in the way it wound up.
Originally, Bob wanted the sound of classic blues records. He was listening to like Little Walter and all these like classic blues, and they sound exciting, you know. Like, and he said to me, like, why can't my records sound like these great blues records? And so I said they can, but we just got to use the techniques that was used in making those records. So I kind of followed that path in making that emission. And there was this thing called a vocal amp that I kind of invented for him, where he would sing in the mic, but he wouldn't wear headphones, and it would go in through a little Ibanez tube screamer distortion pedal and then into a little amp. So he was hearing his voice come out of this little amp. So because that he was in a room with everybody playing, there was a sound from the room going into his vocal mic and then coming out of that little amp. So it's like there was some kind of like a mix of that room still coming. So when he would sing, if you just listen to the vocal mic by itself, you heard everything else in the room too. And so that mixed with close-up microphones highlighting people's instruments was a part of that sound. So you're getting a mixture of two different sounds blended together. And I think that's why you have that kind of the air around everything kind of sound it's hard to pinpoint, you know? And so it's definitely a sound that you don't get in a normal studio, but this one, because of him making records, getting that sound was the same way that those blues records were made, where the lead singer was in the room with the band, and a lot of that sound was going into that vocal mic, and they may have had compression on it, which made it more exciting. So I think the techniques were very similar, and I think that's why he really enjoyed the sound of that record.
Is there very much overdubbing on it? I mean, you had talked before about, you know, that Lenoir was in another room working on things sometimes while you guys were recording. How much additional work was done, you know, that wasn't live, let's say?
You know, there was some vocal corrections, you know, where he wanted to change a couple of lines here or there. And that was kind of difficult too, because if I punched in to change one of the vocal lines, the band wasn't playing in that vocal mic, and suddenly you get this kind of vacuum effects, like, you know, it's like suddenly it's just dry, there's his vocal. So I had to set up two speakers in front of him while he sang into the microphone, piping just the band track coming out of those speakers to reproduce the band in the room. So when I punched in, the leakage would not go away. So it helped. And so he wouldn't wear headphones, and he would just listen to his vocal amp. So me being in a control room, which was kind of difficult, so I had to have another microphone set up above him so I could hear him, because he didn't want to hear his voice coming out of those speakers. He wanted to hear it coming out of that amp. So I had to have this technique where when he sang, I punched him in, I had to pull his vocal channel down, then listen off a little amp that I had set up in the control room. Then when I punched out, I had to bring that vocal down and then bring the vocal that was on tape back up again, so he knew where he was in the song. So it was a kind of a crazy way to work, but he really dug that I was able to do it. So
yeah. How many overdubs on vocals were done when you got back to Teatro after you left Miami?
We tried a couple of songs where he wanted to try redo them, and it ended up where we just ended up using all the all the vocals from Miami that were tracked along with the band. So yeah, so and then he only did like one guitar overdub on the whole record once we got back to Teatro. And so we Dan brought out this Green Gretsch guitar, and Dylan played it on every song. So he just loved the sound of this guitar. So he made me play, he played kind of like a version, not a version, but he played a track on each one of those songs. So there's a Green Gretsch on all of them. So that's the only overdub that happened after that.
I want to try to clear up one other thing. You and I exchanged some emails about this Neve that's down at the Church Studio. That
yes.
came from the Teatro. That they've got a big sign on it that says it. You know, Time Out of Mind was recorded on that console. But you suggested that it came from Teatro, but it's a different Neve.
Yeah. So what I had at the Teatro, I had started on it was called a Neve 8068, and it was only a 24 channel one, and so we started with that desk, and that's the desk that I made that after we came back from Miami. That's the desk I used to mix everything on. And then after that, another 8068 came available from Triclops Studio in Atlanta. And so I went to Atlanta, dismantled, brought it back to the Teatro, and I glued the Bob Dylan console, the 24 channel one, onto this 48 channel console that came from Triclops, which was two consoles glued together already made that this guy Fred Hill had done. And so that console was came out of A&R Studios in New York that John Lennon had done Double Fantasy on. And then there was another console glued onto that was from the Good Brothers. And so the Dylan console was just slid onto the side. And then I think the console you're talking about is the bigger one, which is the Willie Nelson Teatro record that I mixed on that console. And so the other smaller console was sent, somebody else had bought, but so it's not actually the Dylan console. So
the clarity is though that the Dylan one was a 24 track and this one is a 48 track. So that's it's pretty easy to tell them apart.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you can always tell them apart because, if you look at the meter bridge, I think it was the Dylan one, there was a meter that was blacked out on it. And so there's like, you can see where the two volume meters and then right below it, there was supposed to be two more meters and they were blacked out. So that's how you can always tell, you know, which desk was which one.
All right, Mark, I know we're out of time, but the book is called Recording Icons in Creative Spaces. It's a beautiful book, and you're getting it out just in time for Christmas gifts for everyone and who cares about music. And thanks for coming back and talking again.
Yeah, well, thanks, Greg. And thanks for doing this for my book. And hopefully people will love it, and I think it's really a beautiful book, and everybody I show it to loves it. So I think it's going to do well.
Yeah, no, it's really a look at the process that you don't get, and it took a few times looking at it to start appreciating that this kind of behind the scenes nature of it, that you're not catching these people, you know, all primped up and ready for a photograph. You just can really see them focusing on their work. And and there's a lot of, you know, a lot of famous faces and bodies hanging out in all those photos. A lot of motorcycles too.
They were always part of a lot of those sessions, from Dylan to there's always motorcycles around the studio. So it became like the way to escape from the studio. You take a ride and clear your head out. And so I just kind of like documented what bikes were in what period. So it was kind of cool.
Yeah, I wondered about if in all those, you know, homes and mansions and casual locations, if the mix of work and play became an issue. They're very comfortable environments.
Yeah. I think they come hand in hand with each other. You know, like you work, and then you got to be able to kind of like air out and kind of get perspective on things. And so, and that's what Dylan really loved. He loved to take rides on his bike and come back, and you know, because he didn't know what we were doing until he kind of took a ride and made sense to him, like how we were approaching it. So I think he appreciated it. So it's good.
Thanks for listening.